Hello, this is Tom Scott with the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, November 26th, 2025. We begin our reading on the front page with a political story, headlined, "Right Now, I Don't Intend to Run Again," Mayor says. Paxton. Toward the end of the November 18th annual meeting of the Joint Review Board for Paxton's Tax Increment Financing District, former City Alderman Bill Wiley, now a public representative on the JRB, commended Mayor Bill Ingold for the TIF district's success in revitalizing the downtown and attracting development along the West Ottawa Road corridor around Interstate 57, and for the countless hours of work that the longtime mayor has invested in helping to make it all happen. Wiley asked the 76-year-old Ingold, who is now about 7 months into his 21st year as mayor, how the momentum would be kept going once Ingold finally retires from the elected position he has held since 2005. "I think Bill Ingold is a hero, but someday he's going to run out of gas," Wiley said. "Is there some councilman who's really up to speed on this thing and could assume a leadership role to keep it rolling?" Wiley asked Ingold before turning to City Attorney Tony Schering and asking, "Tony, what happens whenever an experienced mayor decides he's going to pack it in? If and when that day ever comes, assuming that whoever replaces Mayor Ingold will still have me as city attorney, I will be there to help them, as the city council, I'm sure will," Schering replied. Ingold, who was elected to his sixth four-year term as mayor last spring, said he has been preparing for the inevitable, finally stepping away from public office, and is leaning towards doing so once he serves out the remaining three-plus years of his new term. In the event Ingold were to choose to run for re-election in 2029 and serve one more four-year term, he would match his late predecessor, Jim Kingston, as the city's longest-serving mayor ever at 28 years. "Right now, I don't intend to run again, just because of my personal life, my wife's health," said Ingold, who has been married to his wife, Lynn, for 55 years. "With that, I'm not ever going to say never, but that's the way it's looking right now." After Ingold retired in summer 2016 from a lengthy career in farm equipment sales and service, mayor became a full-time job for Ingold, despite earning what he equated to only about $3.70 an hour. With Paxton having no city manager, Ingold has helped manage much of the day-to-day tasks of one, and the work has not gone unnoticed. "A substantial portion of the community understands how hard Bill works on a daily basis for the city," Schering said. "Because the next mayor may not have the same available time, though, and because Ingold's time, too, could become more limited while he is still in office, talks have already been underway for about the possibility of creating a part-time position to assist the mayor with various administrative tasks. One of the things I was thinking about was, in lieu of having a city manager, is to have an executive assistant or someone like that who can do the day-to-day stuff of the mayor and be not as expensive as a city manager, but would still be there and would be able to carry on doing that," Ingold said. "There's not too many people who have a real job who are going to support a family on $3.70 an hour, and I use my own truck. So, do we need to find somebody to help? Yeah, we do. It's one of those things where I don't want an oh no moment where something happens and I drop dead, and then everybody's scrambling trying to do this job. Also, to help ensure a seamless transition, Ingold said he has files of information organized for the next leader to use. I feel I have a pretty good backbone of information there when somebody would take over, that they could go to my files, find out what's going on," Ingold said. Engel noted, there is also good support staff as far as the leadership in the city itself, as far as the jobs and responsibilities of everybody. With the attorney, Schering, with the financial advisor, Freddie Beth Schmoody, that we have, it should be a seamless transition. Wiley again thanked Engel for his dedication to the community, calling him a hero. Engel, who served as an alderman from 1990 to 2005 before being elected mayor, said receiving praise was never the goal. Statues don't mean a lot when you're gone, and that's not what I'm looking for, Engel said. But I'm very proud of what we've done. Under Engel's watch, the downtown has seen lots of improvements, including new storefront awnings and facades, fully renovated buildings, and a reconstructed Market Street, complete with new sidewalks and curbs. There has been economic development along West Ottawa Road as well, where there is a new 41-room hotel and a new car wash, and where there is expected to soon be a new convenience store and fast food restaurant. We've gone quite a ways away from where we started off with financially in the city to where we are today, Engel said of the city's finances. I am just super proud of that. Back on the front page, again from the Paxton City Council, Council sets rules for public to record meetings. City Attorney says Attorney General considers such rules required under state law. Paxton. The Paxton City Council has approved regulations governing the public's right to record the proceeding of its meetings. The Council formalized its new rules for the non-official recordings of public meetings during its monthly meeting on Tuesday, November 18th, when it voted unanimously to amend Chapter 30 of the City's Code of Ordinances to include the restrictions. City Attorney Tony Schering said most public bodies that he represents have lacked such regulations, but he has been recommending they adopt them now after having learned that the Illinois Attorney General's Office Public Access Bureau, which is responsible for enforcing and interpreting the Open Meetings Act, considers the adoption of such rules a requirement under the law. Section 2.05 of the Open Meetings Act states that any person may record the proceedings at meetings required to be opened by this act to tape, film, or other means, and the authority holding the meeting shall prescribe reasonable rules to govern the right to make such recordings. Public Access Counselor's position as it relates to Section 2.05 of the Open Meetings Act is that the word shall in Section 2.05 means you are required to have rules established for the recording of meetings by the public, and if you do not have them, that, in and of itself, is a violation of the Open Meetings Act, Schering told the alderman. And, kind of by extension, if you do not have them, you cannot impose any regulations, any restrictions at all, period, because you don't have any regulations. So aside from the technical issue of whether or not the absence of regulations is, in and of itself, a violation of the law, I think we need to be in a position where we can impose some restrictions in the event we need to. So I tried to draft something here that is kind of as simple and common sense as humanly possible. I think the regulations themselves are pretty lenient. They're not designed just to outright restrict recording. It's just designed to create the sandbox, if you will, where it's acceptable and under what circumstances. Alderman Joe Reinhardt asked Schering to explain each new rule. I feel like free speech is such a touchy issue that it might be smart just to go through it so that we're clear to the public what's not being restricted, Reinhardt said. Schering obliged, reviewing each of the seven regulations individually. 1. All recording equipment must be of a type that will operate quietly and unobtrusively so as not to disturb or disrupt the meeting. Recording equipment includes any and all artificial light sources, standalone cameras, microphones, headphones, tripods, cellular phones, and or tablet computers, the ordinance states. It has to be quiet, Schering said. We can't have a gas-powered camera. I don't know if one exists, but if it does, they can't use it. And we're not going to have people setting up TV-style lights in the back of the room. 2. No artificial lighting source may be used in conjunction with recording equipment during the meeting. We don't need spotlights, Schering said as an example. We don't need studio lights. It's all lit up in here already. 3. Recording equipment may not be placed in a manner that blocks, impedes, disrupts, or frustrates the ability of a person to safely exit or otherwise move around the room in which the public meeting is taking place. That means we can't put a camera on a tripod in front of the only door out of here, the council chambers, as an example, Schering said. 4. Recording equipment may be restricted by the mayor or presiding officer to designated areas of the room in which a public meeting is being conducted, but such area must have a clear view of the proceedings. This situation typically comes up with larger units of government, where you'll have multiple news channels or multiple cameras that want to be set up in the meeting room, so they designated specific areas of the room. We reserve the right to do that, but we can't say that they can only be at one end of the room, pointed to the wall. It has to be in a place where you can see the room and you can understand what is going on. 5. Recording equipment shall not be placed on nor behind the tables at which the mayor, city council, and/or city officials are located. This is more so aimed at cameras. We don't want cameras sitting at each individual desk, Schering said. You do run a risk. If a camera is set up in a way that captures an attorney-client privileged conversation, privilege no longer applies if it's recorded. So there are instances where we do have to protect that, and that's really what number 5 is intended to do. 6. Recording equipment may only be placed on any podium or other lectern provided for persons to address the public meeting, if said recording equipment is of a kind that is unobtrusive and or with the consent of the persons addressing the public meeting. It really doesn't apply, Schering noted, because we don't typically have a podium. Even so, Schering said, the rule does not seem unreasonable in the event we ever have a podium. 7. If a witness at any meeting required to be open by the Illinois Open Meetings Act refuses to testify on the grounds that he or she may be compelled to testify if any portion of his testimony is to be broadcast or televised, or if motion pictures are to be taken while he or she is testifying, the City Council shall prohibit any recording being made during the testimony of the witness. Schering said this regulation is listed in the Open Meetings Act itself. I know this sounds like there are a lot of instances where we would be able to tell somebody to turn the cameras off, Schering said, but that is not what this is. This is for if we have someone in here in a meeting who is explicitly here to testify. That is not the same thing as a public comment. It is only in a testamentary capacity. If you're here giving testimony and we're adjudicating some issue, that person can object to being recorded on the basis that you can't be compelled to testify when the testimony is being recorded. It's a statutory right to restrict recording. It's one that was included in the Open Meetings Act, so all we're doing with number 7 is saying that this meeting means that we're going to apply the Open Meetings Act and apply the limitations in there. To be clear, this does not mean that you can object to being recorded in public comment, because public comment is not this kind of testamentary issue. This isn't restricting the right to record other parts of the meeting. It's simply for if there is a person who is brought here for the purpose of testifying, they do not have to do it if they object, That's all. That's all. After Schering reviewed the rules, Alderman Mike Wilson made the motion to approve them. These restrictions seem to have fairly common sense, Wilson said. The new policy applies to all meetings of the City Council, plus all subsidiary bodies of the city, according to the ordinance. And up back on the front page, the latest in the lawsuits against PBL. Confidential information protected under judge's order. Protective order entered by judge in lawsuits versus Paxton Buckley Loda. Paxton. Attorneys for the five plaintiffs and five defendants named in lawsuits alleging the inappropriate touching of female students at Paxton Buckley Loda schools by former coach and suspended teacher Robert Pacey will be allowed to designate certain records shared in the discovery process as confidential, prohibiting their disclosure to the public. Following a November 18th status hearing, McLean County Judge Rebecca Foley entered a protective order pursuant to Illinois Supreme Court Rule 201C to prohibit the disclosure of confidential information contained in all materials produced or adduced in the course of discovery, including initial disclosures, responses to discovery requests, and deposition testimony and exhibits. The protective order was requested by attorney Bhavani Ravidran of Chicago-based Ravidran Law, LLC, who filed a series of lawsuits on behalf of five current and former PBL students last summer, later consolidating the cases into one, alleging that Pacey inappropriately touched them and other female students over the course of his 17 years of employment at PBL, and that administrators did not properly address students' claims of misconduct, ignoring the district's own policies by never notifying the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services as required. Pacey, who was suspended with pay last spring from his job as a STEM and technology teacher at Clara Peterson Elementary School, has not been criminally charged and has denied any wrongdoing. According to the protective order, confidential information can to be prohibited from public disclosure in the civil case, which names Pacey, the school district, PBL Junior High School Principal Josh Didier, and former superintendents Travis Dooley and Cliff McClure, as defendants, should be designated as such by the producing party. It includes any information already prohibited from disclosure by law, student records, including disciplinary records, medical or mental health information, the names of plaintiffs, employment or school records of any party or witness to the case, employment, disciplinary, or other information of a sensitive nature regarding the plaintiffs, defendants, or witnesses, income tax returns, and documents designated as confidential by a third party obtained via subpoena. Such information includes private information in personnel files, such as employment applications, performance evaluations, tax forms, requests for medical leave, and the like, as well as personal and family information of employees, agents of PBL, including residential information of any party, the order said. Also prohibited from disclosure are any sensitive personal data of minor students, including investigative materials and interviews related to the district's completed Title IX investigation or separate investigations by the Illinois State Police, Illinois State Board of Education, Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, Champaign County Children's Advocacy Center, or the district, the order says. With limited exceptions, the confidential information may be reviewed only by the parties and their attorneys, court personnel, contractors hired to make copies of documents, consultants, investigators, or experts hired by the parties, or legal counsel, witnesses to whom disclosure is reasonably necessary during their depositions, and the author or recipient of the document, the order said. Others may see the documents only with written consent of the producing party or upon a court order. Those who would see the documents would first be required to sign a certification acknowledging their obligations under the protective order and the potential penalties for violating it, including a charge of contempt of court. The order does not affect the use of any document or information at any hearing or trial, Foley noted. A party that intends to present or that anticipates that another party may present confidential information at a hearing or trial shall bring that issue to the court's and party's attention by motion or in a pretrial memorandum without disclosing the confidential information, the order said. The court may thereafter make such orders as are necessary to govern the use of such documents or information at hearing. The protective order also applies only to documents filed in court, not the school district's responses to the Illinois Freedom of Information Act requests. In granting the protective order, Foley denied an additional measure requested by Ravindran that would have required PBL to give the plaintiffs 3 days' notice whenever information related to their civil cases is released in response to Freedom of Information Act requests. The school district's attorney, Michael Bersani of Itzhaka-based Hervis, Condon, and Bersani PC, argued that the requirement would go beyond the court's discretionary authority. Nothing in this order shall apply to, limit, or prohibit the school district's response to public requests under the Illinois Freedom of Information Act, the protective order says. Protective order remains in force through the resolution of the case. Meanwhile, attorneys for the defendants told Foley during the November 18th status hearing, held remotely via Zoom, that they were on track to meet their deadline of Friday, December 12th, to file responsive pleadings in the case. Foley set a status hearing regarding the responsive pleadings for 10 a.m. Monday, December 29th, via Zoom. Foley was reassigned to hear the case lawsuits after the filing in Ford County Circuit Court. And now we'll turn to the obituaries in the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, November 26th. Lewis Chandler, Buckley. Lewis Chandler, 89, of Buckley, died at 3:43 p.m. Wednesday, November 19th, at his home. Funeral services were held Monday, November 24th at the Bayer Family Funeral Services in Buckley with the Reverend J. Kevin Wyckoff officiating. Burial followed in the Woodland Cemetery in rural Buckley with military honors by the Buckley American Legion Byron A. Hickerson Post 432. Memorials may be made to St. John's Lutheran Church in Buckley or IMH Hospice. Ronald D. Gerdes, and that's spelled G-E-R-D-E-S, Cisna Park. Ronald D. Gerdes, 83, of Cisna Park, died Thursday, November 20th at the Iroquois Resident Home in Watseka. Funeral services were held Tuesday, November 25th at St. John Lutheran Church at Ash Grove with the Reverend Dale Fjordbotten officiating. Burial followed in St. John's Lutheran Cemetery at Ash Grove with graveside military rites by the Cisna Park American Legion Post number 527. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to St. John's Lutheran Church at Ash Grove, the Cisna Park American Legion Post number 527, or the Cisna Park Fire Department. Randy S. Hurt, Piper City. Randy S. Hurt, 67, of Piper City, died in his sleep on Tuesday, November 18th, at his home. Per his wishes, cremation rites are being accorded, and there will be no services at this time. The family requests that memorials may be made to any humane society. Dorothy A. Janssen, Buckley. Dorothy Alin Janssen, 100, a former resident of the Buckley and Bales Lake areas, died Monday, November 17. Funeral services were held Wednesday, November 26, at the St. John's Lutheran Church in Buckley, with the Reverend J. Kevin Wyckoff officiating. Burial followed in St. John's Cemetery in rural Buckley. Memorials may be made to St. John's Lutheran Church in Buckley or to an organization of the donor's choice. Gary T. Latin, Gibson City. Gary T. Latin, 64, of Gibson City, died Friday, November 14th at his home. A private family service will be held. Memorial contributions may be made to the family, the American Diabetes Association, or the American Cancer Society. Richard Weller, Chatsworth. Richard Dick Weller, 79, of Chatsworth, died Wednesday, November 12th at his residence in Fort Myers, Florida. A celebration of his life will be held for family and friends in the spring of 2026 in his hometown of Chatsworth. We'll return to the news with some news of upcoming events. Today, Friday, November 28th, Paxton's Christmas Tree Lighting Ceremony downtown. Paxton's annual tree lighting ceremony will be at 7 p.m. Friday, November 28th. At the intersection of State and Market Streets. The tree lighting ceremony will feature the presentation of the annual Christmas Star Award, which goes to a Paxton resident who embodies the holiday spirit, the announcement of the Paxton Park District's Christmas Prince and Princess, a welcome address by Mayor Bill Ingold, the blessing of the tree, and the singing of Christmas carols. Then, on Saturday, November 29th, Paxton's Annual Christmas Parade. Paxton's Annual Christmas Parade, sponsored by Pride in Paxton, is set for 1:30 p.m. Saturday, November 29th on Market Street in downtown Paxton. The theme for this year's parade is Once Upon a Christmas. Bands, organizations, churches, businesses, individuals, and families are encouraged to participate, and entry forms are available at a picket fence florist in downtown Paxton. Judges will choose the best in show entry, best theme oriented entry, and most unique entry. Parade entries should not include any Santa figurines or characters, because Santa is already scheduled to appear at the parade's end, and having more than one in the parade could confuse small children. Vehicles should be decorated with garland, wreaths, or lights, or at least decorated in some manner. There is no fee to have a float, vehicle, or walking entry in the parade, and entries are accepted all the way up until it begins. Lineup will begin in its usual location on Taft Street, with the parade moving along Orleans Street by the Paxton Carnegie Library before heading north on Markin Street through the downtown. For more information, people can contact Don Glad at 217-379-4245. And that's all the time we have for this week's reading of the Ford County Chronicle. This is Tom Scott. I look forward to reading with you again very soon.